Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. And we have on the show with us today, again, Dr. Granville Sewell, professor of mathematics at the University of Texas, El Paso, and author of the recent book out by Discovery Institute Press, In the Beginning and Other Essays on Intelligent Design. Dr. Sewell completed his PhD in mathematics at Purdue University in 1972 at the age of 23, and he's since that time been employed in a number of different academic venues, such as the University of Simon Bolivar in Caracas, Venezuela, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, Purdue University, IMSL Incorporated in Houston, the University of Texas, El Paso, of course, the University of Texas Center for High Performance Computing, and Texas A&M University. So, Dr. Sewell, thank you for coming back on the show to talk about your new book today.
Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned in the first podcast, I very much enjoyed reading your book, In the Beginning and Other Essays on Intelligent Design, because I just found it to be very thoughtful. And in this second podcast on your book, I want to get into some of the more personal essays that are in your book, as well as talk about evolution and biological origins. So let's start off with some of the more scientifically oriented questions. In your book, you write that you, quote, know a good many mathematicians, physicists, and computer scientists who, like me, are appalled that Darwin's explanation for the development of life is so widely accepted in the life sciences, unquote. Why do you feel that so many mathematicians are skeptical of neo-Darwinism and the reigning orthodoxy in biology?
It's not because it requires any advanced mathematics to understand the problems with Darwinism. Perhaps it's just because mathematicians and physicists and so forth are very logical people, and Darwinism is a very illogical theory.
Well, you talk quite a bit about technological evolution in your book and how it requires an intelligent force in order to evolve. Is this a fair comparison?
We talk about the evolution of software or airplanes, knowing that there was actually design involved. In fact, I talk a good bit about the evolution of my 35-year-old computer program, in a sense, sort of a common descent. You have new versions that are similar to previous versions, and same thing with the development of airplanes or any other type of technology. We see new versions coming out periodically that bear strong resemblance to previous versions, and yet we know there was design actually involved in spite of the fact that we talk about their evolution. In a recent blog post, Cornelius Hunter said he had no idea what the 21st century theory on the origin of species will look like, but he is sure it will still be called evolution. Maybe we can hope in the best case that this will be the way we all look at evolution eventually as a process, but where it's understood that there was design behind this process. In other words, we may still call it evolution, but evolution in the sense of evolution of software or airplanes where there's understood to be design involved.
You spent a great deal of time also in your book developing your argument that a computer program cannot evolve by random mutations. Could you outline this argument for our listeners and explain why intelligence is necessary to produce a functional computer program?
Well, Darwinism is based on the idea that major improvements can be broken down into many very minor improvements. That just isn't the way it works in software design. Major improvements have to be made in large, irreducibly complex steps. In my 2000 Mathematical Intelligencer article and also in my 1985 software reference book, I made the comparison between evolution of software of this software and the evolution of life. There are striking similarities. They're both done step by step with similarities between each version and the previous version. But minor improvements may require small steps. The major improvements, when you go from solving a single equation to a system of equations, or one linear system solver to another, or two-dimensional problems to three-dimensional problems, for example, these big steps, it's not possible to break them down into small improvements. They're done in one big step, maybe not one big step, but a few large steps anyway, but not in very small steps. And we see the same thing in the evolution of life. The major improvements, which would correspond to new orders, classes, and phyla, require large steps. It's exactly what we see in the fossil record. So, in fact, I made an analogy between what we see in the fossil record and the history of development of my finite element program. The large steps where major improvements were made and smaller steps where minor ones were made.
Well, Dr. Sewell, here's an area that I have to admit that I was a little bit skeptical at first when I read your book, and you may know where I'm going with this because I think that it's one of the areas of your book that you probably will get a lot more questions about. I personally was always of the opinion that the second law of thermodynamics didn't really offer much of an objection to Darwinian evolution because, after all, it only applies to closed systems and the Earth is not a closed system. And that's sort of the view that I had always held. My sense was always that those who made this argument had a valid intuition that blind natural processes do not produce new complex biological features, but I thought that they had basically misstated the objection. But your argument is a little bit different and definitely a little bit more nuanced than the classical argument against evolution from the second law of thermodynamics. And I'd like to give you the opportunity to state your argument and explain why you feel that the second law of thermodynamics still poses a challenge to evolution, even though the Earth is an open system.
Well, first, it's simply not true that the second law only applies to closed systems. That's what the Chapter 5 is about. It's absolutely not true, not from a mathematical point of view, not from a common sense point of view. It does apply to open systems, just in a little different form. The short explanation is that the second law is all about probability. It uses probability at the microscopic level to predict macroscopic change. Everything the second law predicts is based on probability at the microscopic level to predict macroscopic change. And the laws of probability do not apply only to closed systems. They apply to open systems also. It's just that in open systems, you have to take into account what's crossing the boundary to decide if something's extremely improbable or not. In my 2001 Mathematical Intelligencer article called Can Anything Happen in an Open System, I stated the tautology, quote, if an increase in order is extremely improbable when a system is closed, it is still extremely improbable when the system is open, unless something is entering which makes it not extremely improbable. And in fact, there I looked at the equations for entropy change in open systems and showed that they actually support this view rather than the idea that anything can happen in an open system. And it's still extremely improbable that the basic forces of nature would reorganize the basic particles of nature into libraries full of encyclopedias, science texts and novels, and computers and the internet, even if the Earth does receive energy from the sun. This is probably the most original and important idea in my book, main topic of Chapter 5 and also Chapter 6 and a little bit in a couple of other chapters, certainly the most original thing in the book. It's impossible in a short podcast to really give it a fair hearing, so I would suggest that listeners, first they might read the book. Chapter 5 will give it a fair hearing, but short of that, you could simply go to YouTube and search on my name, Granville Sewell, and you'll find a 10-minute video that makes this point very clearly.
Well, I wanted to turn from a topic where maybe I was a little bit skeptical of your argument to one where I couldn't agree more. And if you don't mind, I'd like to quote your book again, where you write, quote, although the similarities between species in the same branch of the evolutionary tree may suggest common descent, similarities, not only morphological similarities such as eyes or wings, but similarities in the DNA sequences as well, also frequently arise independently in distant branches where they cannot be explained by common descent. This phenomenon known as convergence suggests common design rather than common descent. The probability of similar designs arising independently through random processes is very small, but a designer could, of course, take a good design and apply it several times in different places to unrelated species, unquote. I couldn't agree with you more here, Dr. Sewell, and I'm wondering, can you explain why you feel that common design is a viable scientific hypothesis, and explain one of the examples that you give in your book, that of convergence in carnivorous plants?
The example you're referring to was basically a reference to a Nature Encyclopedia of Life Sciences article by Linish and Becker, and I'll quote that. It says from their article, carnivory in plants must have arisen several times independently of each other. The pitchers might have arisen seven times separately, adhesive traps at least four times, snap traps two times, and suction traps possibly also two times. The independent origin of complex synchronized structures, which are often anatomically and physiologically very similar to each other, appears to be intrinsically unlikely to many authors, so that they have tried to avoid the hypothesis of convergence as far as possible. Well, at the least, convergence certainly shows that similarities don't necessarily prove common descent, because in these cases, they are similarities that arose independently on distant branches of the evolutionary tree, and so certainly cannot be explained by common descent. Of course, similarities sometimes do indicate common descent. For example, the similarities between apes and humans certainly suggest common descent, but not convergence. And seems like a more reasonable explanation would be common design rather than common descent. I mean, we see that same sort of thing in the evolution of airplanes or, you know, any technological evolution software. We will see similar changes made independently in distant branches in the evolution of airplanes or cars. Ford will make a change and GM will make the same change to their auto, since not common descent is common design.
That's a very good point, Dr. Sewell. And I'd like to turn also to the origin of human consciousness. You talk about the Turing test in your book and how the ultimate test of a truly conscious computer is whether it can fool someone into thinking that it really is conscious. And I don't know, do you ever watch the TV show The Office, Dr. Sewell?
If I did, I wouldn't admit it.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I was recently watching one of their new episodes where basically...
Yeah, I'm afraid I have, yes.
Oh, you have? Okay, yeah. Wonderful. All right, well, don't be ashamed. It's a great show, and I don't know if you saw the new episode where an inspector comes into the office, and the office manager, Michael, he's boasting to the inspector about the technological upgrades that he's made to the office, and one of which is what he calls Computron, which is supposed to be a computer that can answer any question that you asked it. But of course, it's really just another employee on a speakerphone who's listening and answers questions. So, you know, maybe this shows that it actually takes real intelligence to mimic and reproduce intelligence. But Dr. Sewell, do you think the material explanations will ever explain the origin of human consciousness, or will we ever create a machine that truly passes the Turing test?
I wouldn't say that it's not possible that we'll ever create a machine that truly passes the Turing test. That's not the main point in this section. My point was that even if we do create a machine that passes the Turing test, that does fool anyone into thinking that they're talking to a human when they're really talking to a computer, even if we do, and I think it's possible it might at least fool gullible people. My point was that even if a machine is developed that does pass the Turing test, I don't think it's reasonable to believe that makes it conscious. I don't believe there'll be someone inside the Intel processor that experiences the same consciousness that I do, has the same feelings that I do, or any kind of feelings. The point is, Darwinists see humans as just complicated robots of the type that we could build ourselves someday. I simply don't agree.
I think that's a very interesting point, Dr. Sewell, that if we could build a machine that could pass the Turing test, would that mean that it's actually conscious, necessarily? What about education? How do you feel that evolution should be taught in public schools?
Well, as you know, the discovery policy is not that schools should be required to discuss ID, or teach ID, only that they should teach the controversy over Darwinism, that is, quit pretending that there is no controversy when there obviously is. And basically, I agree entirely with that policy. So my feelings on evolution are exactly what the official discovery policy is.
Well, we appreciate that, Dr. Sewell, especially since the state of Texas, about a year ago actually, did implement a policy that's very close to the sort that Discovery Institute recommends for public science education. You spend quite a bit of time in your book criticizing Lacan's axiom, which is basically that only material causes should be used to explain natural phenomena. And then I recently had the opportunity to engage with a number of atheists. And after about 3 hours of very friendly and civil discussion, their basic objection to intelligent design boiled down to this. Material causes have explained many things, so it's a mistake to ever invoke intelligent design because someday material causes will explain the origin of biological complexity too. It really boiled down to just a very strong faith that they had in scientism. So can you explain to us a little bit more detail, what is Lacan's axiom, and why do you feel that it is actually hindering science's search for truth? For example, you write, quote, Lacan's axiom is useful and philosophically attractive to many, but to abandon belief in an intelligent designer simply because of such an axiom is circular reasoning of the worst sort, yet this is exactly the sort of reasoning on which the whole of modern philosophy is based, unquote.
Okay, first, Lacan's axiom, this is not a common phrase, and I've never heard anybody use that phrase before. It's basically something I discovered in a very old 1888 book by Joseph Lecant, professor at University of California, and I'll give you a couple of quotes here, but it's not a phrase that people will recognize unless they've read my book. But basically, in Lecant's 1888 book, Evolution, first he acknowledges that in the fossil record, quote, species seem to come in suddenly. This looks much like immutability of specific forms and supernaturalism of specific origin. Then he goes on to acknowledge that natural selection cannot explain the appearance of any new organs. Quote, an organ must be already useful before natural selection can take hold of it to improve it. So after acknowledging that fossil record looks like creationism and acknowledging that natural selection can't explain the origin of anything new, he says, quote, we are confident that evolution is absolutely certain, not evolution as a special theory, but evolution as a law of derivation of forms from previous forms. In this sense, it is not only certain, it is axiomatic. The origins of new phenomena are often obscure, even inexplicable, but we never think to doubt that they have a natural cause. So that's where I coined the phrase Lacan's axiom. It's certainly a common axiom to scientists throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century. Now, as to whether it's hindered science, actually, in most cases, it's not hindered science. It may have actually advanced it. But in the case of biological evolution, I believe it is hindering science because it forces scientists to discard an option that seems to be the best explanation. So, you know, as applied to geology and atmospheric science and so forth, I have, maybe a philosophical problem with Lacan's axiom, but I wouldn't say it's hindered science. But it is hindering it now in the case of biological evolution. You're throwing out the best explanation.
I'd like to now come to the last essay in your book. And this is actually a really incredible essay, and it's very personal, it's very compassionate, it's very real, and it really gives us an insight into your own personal story and what has drawn you to your own positions in your life. And this last essay basically looks at the problem of suffering, and the personal story you tell in that essay makes it quite compelling. You quote from C.S. Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain, and one comment by Lewis in the introduction to that book has always struck me as both a logical and compassionate answer to those struggling with a problem of evil. So here's what he says. He says, quote, "The only purpose of the book is to solve the intellectual problem raised by suffering. The far higher task of teaching forgiveness and patience, I was never fool enough to suppose myself qualified, nor have I anything to offer my readers except my conviction that when pain is to be borne, a little courage helps more than knowledge, a little human sympathy more than courage, and the least tincture of the love of God more than all," unquote. So I'd like to ask you, Dr. Sewell, do you agree with Lewis, and why did you include this essay in your book, and why is this topic relevant to the debate over intelligent design?
Well, you know, most people still believe that Darwinism is based on good science, and those who oppose it just don't like its philosophical and theological implications. The truth could not possibly be more opposite to this. The fact is that the evidence strongly favors intelligent design, and it is the philosophical and theological problems people have with ID that make it unpopular with scientists and other intellectuals. And by far the strongest philosophical objection to ID is the problem of pain. Why would a designer create a world that is sometimes so cruel? It's not a scientific objection to ID. It's an emotional one, but even us mathematicians are not entirely logical people. So I thought that ignoring the main objection to ID, even if it's not a scientific objection, would make the book incomplete for most people. So I made an attempt to address it. I'll let the reader decide if it was successful or not. I'd say mixed success. It's a very difficult problem still. Some people at Discovery were initially concerned about including this theological epilogue in a book on ID, understandably because of the criticism Discovery has unfairly fielded as mixing religion and science, which is a criticism that's leveled at all ID proponents. But I clearly set it off as an epilogue so that it was separate from the rest of the book, and they agreed to let me keep it. I'm grateful for that.
Well, Dr. Sewell, I really want to thank you for writing that essay and including it in your book. I think it actually is an important issue to address, and even if it's not a scientific objection to intelligent design, ID obviously does not necessarily consider the morality or, you know, whether or not a design is a painless design or a painful design. Guns and bombs and Microsoft Outlook are all designed, and they cause lots of pain for people. But I think that it's still an issue that lots of people deal with. So I really appreciate the thoughtfulness and the compassionate tone that you take in your book, telling your own personal story.
Okay, the guns, bombs, and Microsoft Outlook. I take it you just had a problem with your email.
Oh, Microsoft Outlook has been the bane of my existence for about 3 or 4 years now. So I put it right there on the par with nuclear weapons and that sort of thing. But I just want to congratulate you on publishing your book. Again, it's In the Beginning and Other Essays on Intelligent Design.
Thank you for publishing it.
Well, we appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on the ID of the Future podcast. And our listeners can go to the website, discoveryinstitutepress.com, to get more information about Granville Sewell's new book, In the Beginning and Other Essays on Intelligent Design. I'm Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.